Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Trevor from Halifax calling in to say that I support Creative Control on Patreon because I think long-form arts journalism is a crucial part of music culture and there's simply not enough of it out there today. Vish is a master interviewer, he lands great guests, and he has his finger on the pulse of the ever-changing music landscape both here in Canada and abroad. For all of these reasons and many more, I think you should support Creative Control on Patreon too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do. And now he has me on the record saying that.
Lee Ranaldo is a talented musician, poet, visual artist, singer, producer, and songwriter based in New York City. A founding member of the hugely influential band Sonic Youth, Ranaldo has been incredibly prolific in his own right, both during the band's existence and especially since the band broke up in 2011. His latest album is a hauntingly unique one called In Virus Times, a solo guitar record which he recorded himself in his home. In Virus Times is available via Mute Records on November 12th, 2021, and it prompted Lee to return to this show to discuss things like The Velvet Underground, Alan Licht, and musical workshops at the Hillside Festival in Guelph, Ontario. Sonic Youth's always and ever-expanding catalog, Bob Dylan, Clinton Halen, and the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Taking a long break from playing guitar or making music during the pandemic and processing the last American presidential election, illustrating and etching a question from a listener, solo and minimal guitar music, playing shows, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol with additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary and friendly staff who will happily help you source special orders for hard-to-find titles, which you can learn more about at their website, blackbird.ca, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is the 648th episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Lee Rinaldo, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Lee. How's it going?
It's going pretty well, Vish. Nice to speak to you again.
Yes, you too. It's only been, I feel like we did, what are we talking, 2020? Is that the last time we spoke or something like that?
I think
feel like
so. I think we talked about names of North End women. Did we meet in Toronto at that point? Or
no? Yeah, it was probably one of my first Zoom calls, frankly.
Right.
Raul and you, I forget where you were. Raul was probably what, in Brazil or something like that?
In Spain and probably in Barcelona.
Oh, Spain. There you go, Spain. Yeah. Yes, yeah, I've already done many of these. Yeah, yeah. So that's the last time we chatted, but it's nice to speak with you again. Actually, your name came up very recently on an episode of this show when I had your friend Alan Licht on. He mentioned that you two had attended the premiere of the new Velvet Underground documentary by Todd Haynes. Was he telling the truth?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And I was aware that you guys spoke recently. That sounds exciting. His new book seems really great.
Oh, it's fantastically. And you are mentioned in it, or Sonic Youth is mentioned in it. Lots of wonderful interviews. It's great. And we were actually recalling the last time, the only time actually Alan and I met was when Lee Rinaldo and the Dust played the Hillside Festival in Guelph many years ago. Do you remember that?
Oh, sure. Sure, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. He was recalling one of his, I asked him just about, you know, memories of it. And he remembered Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet and the Sadies doing Alice Cooper's Love It to Death in its entirety.
I remember as well. He has a good memory for that kind of stuff.
That was a memorable, a whole memorable weekend because I had brought up the fact that you and him and the Dust were also in a workshop with members of Bell Orchest and Colin Stetson and Sarah Neufeld, and you led everyone in a rendition of Revolution Blues by Neil Young.
Yeah, that was a beautiful afternoon. I really enjoyed doing that set almost as much as doing the band set. Just having all those interesting players up on stage together was, you know, that's one of the nice things that happens at those kind of festivals sometimes, that you get strange combinations you wouldn't get just because a bunch of people are around.
Yeah. Normally, I knowing your pedigree, I would imagine you experience those types of things at more improvisational or experimental music festivals, I want to say. You know, I know you're used to that, playing with people in the moment. Was it unusual for you to do was it unusual for you to do such a thing in more of a rock oriented way, the way you did that night?
Well, maybe to some degree, but you know, festivals are getting more adventurous, and when they've got a bunch of people there that are each doing their own kind of more legit sets, they're willing to let them go out on one limb or another to do those kind of things. I was recently listening to a recording that Sonic Youth made at a festival in Scandinavia a few years back. And we did our own set on one day. I think it was Roskilde, but I'm not really sure. And the next day we did a completely improvised set with a sax player, Mats Gustafsson, and Mertz Bau from Japan. And, wow. Jim O'Rourke was with us at the time. And it was one of these sets where we just went out with a crew of collaborators and just an experiment to see what would happen. And it was a really wonderful, hour and a half long or hour long set. And, those kind of things are quite special when they happen.
Yeah. Was that recorded in any way?
It was. It's a release on the, on our SYR label.
Oh, right. Jeez. Okay.
I think it's called Other Sides of Sonic Youth, that one. I forget whether it's number, I think it's number SYR 8 or 7 or 8 anyway.
Do you have a high tolerance for people not being able to keep up with everything you do? Because I, you know me, I'm a big fan of you and Sonic Youth. It's hard to keep up with everything. Would you agree?
Yeah, it is in general. And I don't have a problem with that at all. Even with, artists that I revere, there's always little pockets of like, oh, I don't really know that record very well or this one. And yeah. It just means there's, fruit out there to still be discovered. I was talking to a friend about Bob Dylan recently. I think I'm a big Dylan obsessive, and he's mm-hmm. about to come around on tour, and I'm looking forward to seeing him. He's a national treasure. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about one song from the 21st century, I guess, that they considered to be one of his best. And I said I didn't know it, and it's from the album called Tempest. And I was like, oh, I've heard that record, but I really never dug deep into that record. So it just means there's more out there to find interest in, which is great. Yeah. Sometimes
I will say, for as you may know as well, I'm a massive Bob Dylan fan, and Tempest is about the angriest record I can think of by him, and that includes Blood on the Tracks or what have you. Like it's quite rageful, if you will. And so
yeah,
I would dig deep into it. And it was one of the ones where I reviewed it. I don't know about you, Lee, but I still feel like when those types of entities connect with you on a level, like I know you've worked on the I'm Not There soundtrack, which must have been a thrill. Again, Todd Haynes.
Yep.
Yeah. And so you got to work on a bunch of Dylan songs. That's
yep,
very exciting.
Exactly.
But yeah, I wrote a review of Tempest, and then the Bob Dylan camp shared it, and they acknowledged it, and they've blurbed me before, like on one of this recent what we kind of colloquially call the Sinatra records. I reviewed one,
sure,
and they put me in the press release, and I tell you, that's sort of nothing, but it felt like something. Like, oh my God,
No, it's great. It's great when that happens, and when it happens from a surprising, place like that, like you don't really expect Bob Dylan's people to come out and blurb your words, but that's great, but they seem to be very on top of that kind of stuff. I've been doing some work with the Bob Dylan Center out in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the last couple of years. Well, particularly right before the pandemic, and actually Alan was out there at one point too. They've invited a whole bunch of different people to go out there and comb through Dylan's archives and choose a single item to write about for their catalog that's going to come out when they open their new building next spring.
Oh, nice.
And it's a fascinating place, and it's just, it's a treasure trove for any Dylan obsessive in terms of the kind of stuff they have out there that's unseen by the public, but now available for, I guess scholars or whatever you want to call it, academics to comb through for research.
Yeah, I've also made contact with them, and they've made contact with me, a couple of the people at that center, and they've invited me to come out at some point. And obviously I'm waiting till at least my children are vaccinated. They're under 11 years old. So I'm trying not to,
yep.
You mentioned, like I had my eye on some of those Dylan shows that you're about to see, but I also was like,
yeah,
do I really want to travel at this point? Like I don't want to put people at risk, my family in particular when I come back. So anyway, yeah, I'm hoping to,
yep.
Have you actually, you were physically at the Bob Dylan Center? Did you get to check it out?
Yeah, it was pre-COVID, but I was there for, I don't know, a week or 10 days in Tulsa. And it was, it's an interesting place. And the center is just fantastic, the stuff that they've got there.
Yeah.
It's going to be, I think it's going to be quite a draw when it opens. It's right down the street from the Woody Guthrie Center, mm-hmm. which is also a pretty fantastic place. And, you know, it's really going to be, it's interesting that it's in the heartland rather than on one of the coasts. But in a way, it's sort of fitting for Bob to be in an out of the way location like that, that, you know, people have to sort of make a pilgrimage to.
Yeah, I interviewed one of the curators there, and he mentioned that the Kaiser family, the family that's sort of the they're based out there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's why they got out there. Actually, you know, oddly enough, as we're speaking 2 days ago, I finally finished Clinton Halen's new book about Bob Dylan. And speaking of blurbs, who blurbs the book? You are blurb. You blurb.
Me, yes. We are good friends. Actually, we're going together to Dylan's concert here in New York. I mean, Clinton lives in London, but he's going to be in town, finally, I think, promoting that book. And, you know, it's the first of a projected either two or three volume life of Dylan. And, it really draws heavily. It's maybe not so much the first volume, but the next volume for sure is going to draw really heavily on the Tulsa archives. And yeah, we're old friends at this point.
Oh, nice.
And,
that's cool.
He's quite a character.
Yeah, it's interesting. For those who haven't read the book, and I may, maybe I'll reach out to Clinton to see about a chat, because that's why they sent me the book, you know. But I find his tone a bit curious. I can't tell I can tell he loves Bob, but I can also tell he doesn't really like him somehow. You know what I mean? He picks at him a little bit. That was my reading of the thing. You might have some insight about this because you know him, but do you know where I'm coming from with that a little bit? He calls him like a liar.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure. He has a very personal writing tone.
Yeah.
And I think it's come to the fore as he's written more and more books and he's sort of garnered more and more readers. And he writes a lot of stuff about Bob, but he's a prolific author. He's written about Shakespeare. He's written about Orson Welles, you know, as well as some really classic books in the rock genre, from the Velvets to the Voidoids being one of the early ones. That's a really fantastic book for anyone that wants to read about the New York scene in particular and the rise of punk rock in the late 70s. Mm. But he's very opinionated. It's one of the hallmarks of Clinton that people either love or hate or a combination of the two. But he's a very opinionated guy, and his opinions have seeped more and more into his books. And he's enough of a scholar. I mean, his brain is encyclopedic in terms of his knowledge of all this stuff, dates of concerts, you know, not just Dylan, but just all over the map. And he feels he's a sort of expert. And I have to say he is. Yeah. And so he throws his opinions around with the weight of someone who feels that they know what's right and wrong. And, you know, it presents many a moment to have an argument over. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And when I read the acknowledgement at the end of the book, I realized that he thanks a lot of people that I've been in contact with in the Dylan world, including people from the Dylan camp. So he clearly has they clearly have a connection to him in that regard, and they help him. So it's not a hatchet job per se. Like you say, he's an encyclopedia, but he pulls no punches about Bob either. So that's all. It was just, it's an interesting tone. Normally, you know, people like, I don't know about you, but we kind of love the guy. We love Bob. And so we try to give him the benefit of the benefit of the doubt. And I don't think Clinton, in a somewhat refreshing way, doesn't do that. If things are wrong, if he thinks the things are wrong, he'll say it. And that's, yeah,
yep.
It's unusual.
Yep. I think he's trying to be, you know, trying to keep himself fair, you know, in fairness as a critic.
Yeah.
You know, there's been certain biographers over the years of Dylan and other people, like I'm thinking of Albert Goldman, who wrote those awful books about or sort of tawdry books about Elvis and then later John Lennon.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're out to do hatchet jobs. And he's certainly not one of those. Obviously, Dylan is a big part of his life, but he wants to be a critic in the true sense of the word, to laud at the things he thinks are laudable and to tear down the deceits and lies or, you know, fallacies that he sees as well. So I think it's his attempt to be a balanced critic rather than someone who's either fawning or just completely, you know, derogatory.
Yeah.
And And that makes him worth reading.
Yeah, I think it was compelling. I couldn't stop reading it. Like, I there were times where I'm like, why is he saying this? Why does he call him these names? But at the same time, and I also, he's very, I will say, for those who haven't read this book yet, like he is very unforgiving of scholars, other Dylan scholars and critics who feels have done a hell, you know, done short shrift to him, but. You know, he's really in the air right now. I wrote a review of Springtime in New York, this newest bootleg series collection. And again, you know, some fortune falls on me in that the Dylan camp noticed it and blurbed it. Did you check out that collection? I was surprised. Yeah, I was surprised by how much I loved it because it's not my favorite era, but I was surprised and it made me revisit.
Yep.
All of those records, like the proper ones, if you
will.
Same
here.
Yeah.
So same here. And that's what that series does in general. I mean, every one of those periods of the lesser periods, you know, I think I'm thinking of particularly like the self-portrait period, which that record was roundly critiqued when it came out. But the revisionist box set portrays it in a whole different light. And, you know, there's so much rich stuff to find in every period there. It's incredible. And the new collection is no exception. And there's so much there's so much stuff that he left off records that on anybody else's records would be the standout track, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just the quirks of his nature that caused that to happen.
Well, I like talking about Bob. I'm envious that you're going to go see him. So have fun. That's going to be great. I saw the set list from, as we're speaking, he's done, to my knowledge, one show, I think. And, the set list looked cool. I really loved, Rough and Rowdy Ways as well. So, and he's been playing a lot of those songs. So yeah.
Yeah, he's been playing a lot of it. I think he's done two so far.
Oh, is it two?
Last
yeah.
Last night was the second one. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. So it's looking good. Yeah. Well, good luck and have fun with that. So I'm very happy to talk to you about this, surprising release, I suppose. It's a very, very interesting one. It's called In Virus Times. What do you want to say about, I read your, what you call your loner notes, instead of liner notes, which, I think is very clever. And, it's short and brief and it explains it. But for those who don't know, can you talk a little bit about your motivation for making this record and the sound of it too? Can you talk about those things?
Sure. I think the last time we talked, I was probably talking to you about the last record I made, which was made with Raul Raffri from Barcelona, called Names of North End Women. Mm-hmm. And that record came out the end of February 2020. So literally like a week or 10 days before New York in particular and the world basically went into lockdown for, you know, the year and a half that we are either still in or climbing out of, depending on who you talk to. So, you know, all of our plans for the year 2020, we had created a very inventive style of performance as a duo together, kind of playing this very complicated record in a very experimental manner. And we'd made all these plans for the year and then everything stopped, you know, cold for everybody. You know, I think that's mainly the most interesting thing about this last year and a half and this pandemic is that it was maybe the first time in history that there's been such a global phenomenon. You know, it wasn't isolated. This wasn't a war in Europe or Afghanistan or you know, apartheid in South Africa or something. It was the entire world in embroiled in this one tragic event, series of events. And anyway, you know, when that happened and all of our plans got dashed, it was such a confusing time. I mean, I'm sure everybody relates to that statement. We didn't know when it first started if we were going to be locked down for a week or 3 weeks or 6 weeks or, you know, it was just completely unknown and it just kept going on and on. And I was pretty devastated by the fact that, you know, we couldn't present this record and promote this record. Especially since it was a record that was really covering a lot of new territory for the two of us. And we were really hoping to go out and sort of, by way of our performances, sort of explain and show off what we were up to. And I really, at that point, sort of stopped doing music for a number of months. I hardly picked up a guitar. I mean, this is not even just for the first few months, but it's almost kind of gone on right up until today. My moments of working on music since the pandemic began have been quite spotty. Mm. But for the first 4 or 5 months from that, you know, from March into the summer, I don't think I picked up a guitar. Things were just so confusing, and I had been all ready to go out and perform these songs we'd spent the last year writing. And it wasn't in my desire at that moment to sort of pick up a guitar and say, like, well, I'll work on new stuff after having spent a year kind of doing just that, you know? Mm-hmm. So I threw myself into other activities. I was mainly doing visual artworks. I was spending a lot of time sitting at our table in our dining room here and sketching and painting all of these different flowers that my wife Leah was bringing home to sort of brighten up our loft, because we were stuck in it basically 24 hours a day, especially in those early, really paranoid days.
Yeah.
So I started this whole series of watercolors of these flowers. She'd bring them home and they would be, you know, in the burst of bloom, and I would be drawing and painting them, and then they'd start to get withered, and I'd continue, and then they'd be dead, and I'd still be drawing them, and, you know, and then a new batch would come in. And I spent most of the year from March 2020 in particular working on these drawings, and it kind of became a bit of a consuming thing for me, and it was a nice, I have to say, it was kind of a nice break from just the constancy of doing music in a way. You know, it was really a break, and it was a time when the world was both broken and in a break in general. There were no concerts, nobody was doing anything, and in a way, aside from the tragic aspects of this pandemic, it seemed like a moment for refresh and renewal to some degree. And for me, taking a break from music felt in a way like the right thing to do at that moment. Yeah. But, you know, as we moved into summer, I started tinkering with some things again. And by the autumn, I was working on these few different thematic elements on the guitar, and I wasn't really working on them with any particular plan. I wasn't working towards an album or planning, you know, we were certainly not planning performances or anything like that at that point, but I just started tinkering with these few really basic themes. And in a way, when I picked up the guitar sort of late in the summer into September, I felt like I was approaching it almost as a beginner, and as with like a new open perspective on it. You know, I'd kind of lost my technique and forgot all the different tunings and shapes that I had invented for the last batch of songs, and picked it up almost kind of like a beginner. And I started playing this very basic stuff. And recently I've come to liken it, you know, to these drawings I was making, because my main interest, you know, I was sort of sitting around in our living room here at home. I recorded the record here in our living room where I'm talking to you from at home. And I was sitting around in the living room in the evening, and it was dark. And, you know, it was that moment in time. This was September 2020. So here in the States in particular, we had these dual, like, pressing anxieties of the pandemic was still going on. It had now been 6 months. We didn't know if it was going to be 6 years, or, you know, nobody knew what was going to happen, really. We were still, you know, washing our hands furiously and wiping down the doorknobs and stuff when we came in the doors, you know, and all that crazy, I call it paranoia, but it was just safekeeping. Sure. At the time. It was justifiable paranoia, I guess you would say.
Well, it also offered us some measure of like feeling like we could control things a little bit by wearing masks and washing our hands, like just feeling like you were doing something to prevent this thing from entering your home.
Yeah, you weren't sure if it was working, if those precautions were working.
Exactly.
But you were doing what we could.
Yeah.
You know, we were ordering our groceries instead of going to the grocery store and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, just being in this high state of anxiety about the pandemic. And at the same time, we were approaching the US elections. Mm. So we were in this high state of anxiety about the possibility that Trump was going to be reelected. And It was literally one of the most incredibly stressful times I've ever experienced, both as a person and I feel like as a nation, in my lifetime. And these two things were just so oppressive. And, you know, so between them, everyone I knew was basically just kind of like glued to the news 24 hours a day, either hearing about the possibilities of whether Trump was going to be reelected or not, or even early on, like who was he going to face? Was it, you know, going to be Kamala Harris or, you know, all these other potential candidates? And it was a really, really stressful time. And I was just sitting around in the living room playing with the guitar, and I had something going. And so I figured I would set up some proper microphones and just for my own edification, kind of do a real recording of what I was working on instead of using my iPhone or a little handheld recorder or something like that. So I set up some microphones in my living room and by the time I set them up, the sun had gone down. I hadn't turned on any lights and it was just totally dark. And I just started playing, and I felt like what I was doing was akin to these flowers that I was drawing, because I was striking these chords and just kind of letting them bloom into the air and then letting them kind of die and wither away and then striking another one and just kind of repeating. And it felt really primitive to me, and it felt like, you know, basically at that moment in September, to some degree, it felt like, you know, all that I could do or the best that I could do. And, you know, I started to weave these different thematic elements together, and I played for, you know, I recorded in the end, for the record is 22 minutes long, and we can talk about the format, you know, being a single-sided record and all this stuff, but the record is 22 minutes long, but I think I recorded, I don't know, 90 minutes or so of music, of just different themes and variations. And then I spent the next few months sort of intensively working with the material, editing and structuring and sorting out exactly how I wanted to present this stuff. And it literally took me a few months of kind of intense work to whittle it down to these four sections that total 22 minutes. And I felt like I had something nice on my hands, you know? And I recorded here in our living room, so it's not a proper studio. I think I turned off all the sort of noisy fans in the house, but I left the windows open. And so there's a certain kind of ambience to the recording. I mean, the recording is pretty well done, but you can hear noises from the street, and sometimes you hear an occasional siren go by outside, or you hear people talking in the next room or something like that, you know? And at first, when I heard that stuff, I was a little disappointed that the recording wasn't more pure. But the more I thought about it, it really felt like, and the more I listened to it, it really felt like it gave it a purpose and a place. You know, like this was recorded in relative isolation. You know, if you looked out the windows in that period of time, and indeed, I made a video called Isolation based on John Lennon's song that I had covered many years ago. I made a pandemic video for that song. Yeah. Where I asked people I knew all over the world to send in small video clips of their locality, you know, what was going on where they were. And it basically, I got, you know, clips, like I got about 150 clips from all over the world, every continent and all different kinds of places. And it was mostly everyone's empty streets or whoever they were, like someone sitting alone in their their room, in their house or apartment. And it was, you know, it was really this moment that we all shared. So I felt like the manner in which it was recorded was kind of commensurate with what was on the what the music was. And that becomes a part of the recording, in a sense, is just this environmental sound in the background. It's not a pristine studio recording, but it's a lockdown recording, you know, for better or worse.
And it seems like I associate the siren whoop with like a New York siren. It's not a siren. It's not like a woo woo woo. It's that whoop whoop, and it comes in, and it feels like perfect for the mood. And I mean, you're describing the uncertainty that you as a citizen of your country and a citizen of the world during a pandemic were experiencing. And I hear it in the music, and I hear it. It's fascinating to hear you say that, you know, you were coming back to an instrument that you've been playing for most of your life and felt a little unsure of it. And I will say something, like, I've been playing In Virus Times in the house. I was making breakfast for the family today, and I had it on, and my 10-year-old son, who's been hearing it in the house today, said, and I say this with all respect to you, Lee, my 10-year-old son, Levon, he goes, "When's the song going to start?" And I was like, that's interesting. Like, that's just an interesting observation. Like, it sounds like he wants to start. Is it going to start? I'm like, yeah, no, it's on now. It's happening. But yeah. He connected to the emotion of it, I think. Like, on the one hand, I say I'm all respect to you, but I don't think it's insulting. I think you also were like, as you were playing, you're like, you know, is life starting again?
Yeah.
Like, it does have that kind of auspicious quality of tentative triumph. Like, something is going to happen soon, and you're making the guitar sing in a way that it hasn't been able to sing in quite some time. So I just want to say, on an emotional level, and in an emotive sense, like, those qualities definitely come through. And when I hear that whoop whoop, or the chatter that you describe, the ambience, yeah, it adds to that haunting tone of some sort of dystopian uncertainty, you know? Like, I really feel like that comes through, for what that's worth.
Yeah, I love that comment, because in a way, I think that's how I was feeling at the time. Like, when's the song going to start? Like, trying to come back to music in a sense, and feeling like a primitive in a sense, and just, you know, like, I'm just strumming the strings, basically, and listening to this sound. And, yeah, and it's the most basic, primitive aspect of a guitar. You know, you can get very fancy, especially with the left hand, and do all kinds of fancy stuff. And at that point, I felt like I had lost the ability to do all that stuff, or the motivation to do all that stuff, you know, and I just wanted to hear, you know, these strings, you know, resonate in this wooden body and see what it sounded like again, kind of like bringing myself, yeah, back into the fold of the instrument. You know, when the night that I recorded the stuff, when I was setting up the microphones, we had the television on, and it was, I don't know, MSNBC or something like that. And they were reporting on the election. And even in September, they were talking about the possibilities of, you know, Trump stealing the election if he lost, and all, mm-hmm, this stuff. And some of that made its way onto the beginnings of the tape from this evening session. And the first edit I did of the piece had about a minute of this recorded television news broadcast on it, talking about Trump and Biden. And, you know, I left it on there because I felt like it really set the tone, like it really did, like, put a nail down in the ground and said, this piece was recorded in this time period, you know, and it kind of set the stage, basically, for what comes next. And then in the end, MSNBC wouldn't let us use the clip, because they never let anybody, right, use their stuff in any way, basically. It didn't matter. They weren't making a judgment on my content or anything like that. They just never allow that kind of thing. And so, yeah, after fighting, yeah, like hell to keep it, we took it off. And I'm so glad that we did, because, you know, who at this moment in time wants to hear all that baloney anymore? And it allowed the piece, yeah, to sort of be free to live its own life in a sense, and to sort of both be of that time and beyond it, I hope, anyway. And,
you know, it's, as a Canadian here, I have, during that time period that you're describing, I was just flipping manically between MSNBC and CNN and,
yeah,
whatever else.
We all were.
It was stressful. Yeah, well, it was stressful for us too. You know, no offense, America's a bit of a drama queen, and we all end up paying attention to everything it does. And so, but I will say, the election happened, and certainly after the dramatic call that Biden finally won, you know, a week or, yeah, two after the, I can't even remember now, such a blur, but it was a week after the election, I think. I basically have disengaged from all those people. Like, I don't watch that news, those channels at all. And it's fascinating to me, because I was watching them pretty religiously and consuming all of this news just to see what was happening down there. and I've stopped. Are you still watching these things yourself?
No,
as a
you know, I think
citizen?
The experience you just described is a communal one, and certainly yeah. as soon as you know, I mean, it extended through Election Day and January 6th and the Capitol storming and all that kind of stuff, and it's been ongoing. Right. But there was a sense of okay, there's an adult back at the helm, and we can breathe a little bit easier and like turn ourselves to other thoughts. And I've definitely tuned it out to a large degree. You know, I keep up. I read the newspaper every day and whatnot, but I've not yeah. been obsessive about any of that stuff. And, you know, we just had elections here, and yeah. the hysteria is mounting again because certain races that the Democrats were really desperate to hold on to, they did not win. And, you know, and yeah. sort of Trumpers got in and whatnot. And I was reading this stuff and starting to feel that same sort of welling up inside me that I remember feeling so strongly back then. And I just said, you know what? I just have to tune this stuff out right now. It's, and, you know, yeah. live my life basically and just try to get beyond, the petty politics, you know, of the moment as much as yeah. possible. You know?
Yeah, no. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You alluded to the fact that this is a one-sided record. And we actually, yeah. Lee, we actually have a question that came in from a listener. Is it okay if I share it with you?
Sure.
It's Jermaine. Okay, here's the question. Does he connect In Virus Times in any way to his first solo guitar LP, From Here to Infinity, which also had an engraving on the B-side? That question comes to us by one Alan Licht from New York City. Lee, can you speak to Alan's question?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, as I said, I wasn't thinking about this music as an album, or I didn't have any agenda for this music. I was playing something that I liked the sound of, and I wanted to make a decent document of it, you know? And so I set up the microphones, but I hadn't thought like, okay, I'm making a new record or something like that. But when it was done, I was pretty happy with the piece. And Alan is actually one of the first persons that I shared it with in some early mm-hmm. stages. And some of the comments he made and discussions we had back and forth, helped me kind of clarify some things about the piece and helped me finish the piece. And I've acknowledged that on the notes on the back of the back cover of the record that Alan was kind of an early listener and had some comments yeah. that were helpful to me. But I never expected that, you know, my record company is Mute out of London and out of New York here. And I didn't really expect that this was going to be a record that they were going to be interested in. But being respectful of my record company, I have a really good relationship with them. And I think they're a fantastic company, really artist-centric in a way that is not the norm these days. I presented it to them and I said, like, here's what I've been doing. And, you know, I just want you to hear it. And, you know, I probably even said, I don't expect that you're going to want to release this or whatever. And, you know, there's a small label that's recently uprooted from New York and moved to California, and it's called VDSQ. And yeah, it's yeah. a label that puts out, they have a series that they do of exclusively solo acoustic guitar music. And they've put out a bunch of fantastic records. Alan has one on the label. Thurston Moore has one. A lot of different names. And they're as a whole, the series is really pretty great. Yeah. And Steve Lowenthal, who runs the label and who also wrote an amazing book about the guitarist, American primitive, quote unquote, guitarist John Fahey, that I mm-hmm. would highly recommend for anyone interested in John's work. You know, he's been bugging me forever to do something for the label, and I've really wanted to for a long time, and I never had the opportunity to, I never found the right music. And I thought, like, okay, Mute's going to listen to this and say, we'll wait for the next real record, quote unquote, real record. And then sure. I was going to give this record to VDSQ. But Mute came back and said that they loved it and they were really excited by it and they wanted to do it, which, you know, it kind of surprised the hell out of me, but it certainly pleased me. And it was, the folks at Mute, and this is what I mean about an artist-centric label, they, you know, I was also like, you know, it's a 22-minute piece. It's like to break it up and put half of it on one side and half of it on the other side. I mean, they would sound good because there'd be 12 minutes of music on a side or something like that, but it didn't seem conducive to the listening of the piece, because I really think, you know, it's a 20-minute piece. It's not a 2-hour piece. It should be listened to sort of in one sitting mainly. And they
came up with the idea of putting it is divided into four parts, just so people recognize that. But you view this as a whole. Yeah. It's a whole piece.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's four interrelated parts. And they came up with the idea of putting it on one side, and having known that I've actually done two or three records in the past where there were etchings on the vinyl. Some of them, the first one from Here to Infinity that Alan refers to, the etching on side two was done by a London artist named Savage Pencil, long associated in the early days with Sonic Youth, and still a dear friend of ours and still an active artist of some renown. And he did that etching, but you know, there were a few more over the years, and some of them I did myself. And in the last decade, one of my visual art practices has been making these fine art prints that I call black noise, where I trained in school as a printmaker, making additions of, you know, making etchings and things like that, where you're engraving or etching with acid into a metal plate, and then you're printing it on one of those big old presses and making, you know, additions, 10 editions of 10, editions of 20, whatever.
Yeah.
So I've been doing that same kind of technique on vinyl records for the last decade, where I'm scratching images, more often mostly abstract images, into vinyl records, into the soft vinyl of the records with like sharp tools, and then printing them on these printing presses and making these prints. So I have this whole relationship to this idea of scratched in image on vinyl records. And Mute knew about this, and it was also their suggestion to put this etching on the B side. So the A side of the record contains all the music, and the B side contains an etching of an image related to the cover art for the record. The cover art is a sort of a withering flower in amongst this kind of broken chips of glass and stuff that was taken by a friend of mine, a sort of youngish Brazilian photographer. I think she's just an incredible photographer. Her name is Ana Bogaciovas. And she's really quite unknown, but I've done a few sessions with her down there, and she always produces just these absolutely magical, marvelous pictures. And when I saw these images she had created of this flower among this broken glass, it just immediately jumped out at me and said, like, this is the cover image, you know?
That's gorgeous.
So
all the artwork is gorgeous, if I might say. It's lovely. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So we decided to put an image that I had sketched based on one of her flower photographs on the B side of the record. Now, the interesting thing is these days, an etched record is done in a new style. Like, you probably haven't seen the finished vinyl yet, because it's basically just about to hit the shops.
I will tell you, I ordered it myself last night, so it's hopefully in transit at some point soon. Yeah, but I haven't held it in my hands. No, not yet.
Right. So the record is a translucent turquoise blue that matches the cover colors and things. And, you know, normally in the old days, to make one of those etchings on the back of a record, you'd scratch into a record and you'd send it to the plant and they'd make a master from it and all that stuff. But they don't do it these days like that anymore, which in the end, I was a little shocked and disappointed by this, because it's done with like a computer etching process. So you send in a drawing and they transfer it to the vinyl. And so in the old days, if you ran your hand over one of those etchings, it would have a lot of texture.
Yeah.
And these days, it's almost smooth to the surface of the record. Yeah. I'm not exactly sure how they do it, but it's a bit different process.
Yeah.
So it was their idea, you know, knowing that I had done these etchings before, to suggest doing it that way. And I thought, like, well, that's a marvelous idea. Put all the music on one side, do an etching on the back side. It hadn't occurred to me. And then we decided to include a poster of another print I had made on one of these vinyl records. I was playing around with this, you know, in amidst all these flower paintings I've been doing for the last year and a half. I've done a couple of variations based on other things I've seen. And I saw this image I forget where I first saw it, but it was of an electron microscope photograph of a COVID molecule, which, you know, it fit with the theme of the record, even though it was introducing kind of a new image. But the image was remarkable, and it was this these beautiful, like, tones of deep blue, and then these little kind of red, almost berry-like things dotting through the surface. And it just visually struck me. And, you know, I made some watercolor paintings of it, and I decided to do one of these record etchings based on this image. And in the end, we had a bunch of different images from recent prints I'd made that we were trying to decide which one to make a poster to go in the record. And even though this introduced like an image that's not really found anywhere else in the record, it was the one that we most responded to visually between myself and the record company. And so we made a poster edition for the first edition of the record. The first pressing is 2,500 copies. Yeah. And so, you know, normally when you make an etching edition, you sign each copy, you know, you sign it in pencil at the bottom and you number it, you know, 1 of 20, 2 of 20, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And so I suggested to the record company that I wanted to sign the prints by hand. And so we did that. And so there's a printed poster inside the record that is literally hand signed. Yeah. So that it also kind of keeps with this intimate quality of like the recording is made in this kind of intimate way. Mm-hmm. And it's about this very intimate time. And so the first 2,500 have this poster that I literally spent a few long days hand signing all these posters, and we stamped them with one of these like number stamps that, you know, advances every time you hit it. So so they're stamped and signed, which, you know, for me it was a lot of work, but it really added to the personalized touch of this record, which I really liked. And, you know, Mute was really into the idea. So I'm very, very happy with the package as a whole. I think it came out well.
Yeah, I'm looking at a PDF of what I was sent that says it's the liner notes, but everything you're describing is in this PDF I'm looking at in terms of process, like the etching source material, the way the final record looks, you signing these numbered posters. Is this going to be in the final liner notes that we receive when we order the record?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I haven't seen, I've seen one or two finished copies so far. I don't know if the liner notes will be in there, but I think those are more just for the press. But,
the poster
will be in there and the colored record. I think the liner notes are, you know, I think on Mute's website, we made a little video of the, a little 2-minute video with some of the music and some of the imagery from the record and then some images of me sort of like signing and stamping them and all that stuff.
Okay.
But I don't know if the liner notes will actually be in the record. I don't think they are. I think there's just...
I didn't mean to be a braggadocio there for anyone. Like, why does he get them? I'm just... this is... When I say
press,
that the...
The press always gets that.
It's true. We do get stuff sometimes. No, when I say that the artwork looks beautiful, I am referring to this PDF I was sent that is very fascinating. It includes these loner notes that I was alluding to earlier. It's just a very thoughtful and reflective of its time. No pun intended. It's just very thoughtfully packaged and beautifully performed. And like I said, it evoked emotions in various family members of mine, wondering what was going on, what I was doing, scrambling eggs with this droney guitar. And I was like, no, it's good. You'll like it. Just eat your eggs. That's what I said. Anyway, no, it's really wonderful, Lee. And I, you know, I always value your work and getting to chat with you. At this point, I guess I'll ask what's next. Like, this record, has emerged from a period of, for you, some creative reflection, some measure of hibernation. And then you got to it and you sound anyway by this conversation inspired and motivated to work some more. Do you have plans that we should be aware of?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Plans are starting to formulate. It seems like even though we're in limbo to some degree with the virus, you know, things have definitely opened up. And, you know, I was talking to my partner Raul in Spain just a couple of days ago, and he said recently in Europe, the virus is kind of rearing its head again, and things are getting a lot worse in many of the countries. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen going into the fall. We're anxious to renew our collaboration. We did commit to a show in France, as I say, if it can happen in January. And so we're talking about the next steps. But, you know, after 18 months of basically nothing, I played three shows this month, three completely different performances, one a duo with my friend David Watson, who plays bagpipes, a sort of droning duo, electric guitar and bagpipes, another one with these recreated futurist instruments from 1913 that were these noise instruments created by these Italian futurists in Milan in the early part of the 20th century that a composer named Luciano Cessa has recreated about 10 years ago, and I did a performance with 16 of these noise generating instruments and me playing the guitar. And then I did a piece with an electric guitar quartet from Brooklyn called Dither, and the percussionist Brian Chase, who plays with Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and myself playing Fender Rhodes piano, a piece I wrote in 2014, right after Hurricane Sandy had ripped through New York City, based on wind sounds that I recorded during the hurricane. And we just performed this piece here at the Noguchi Museum. We had played it back in 2014 or 2015 a few times, this sextet that I just described with this electric guitar quartet called Dither from Brooklyn. And we never recorded it. So we decided when things started to open up that we would get together. And for all six of us, it was the first time we'd been in a room with other musicians. This is just a month and a half ago. And so just 2 weeks ago, we performed it here at this this museum called dedicated to Isamu Noguchi in Long Island City here. So, you know, things are happening. And actually, next week, my record is released, and I'm going to attempt to perform it next Wednesday night in a small club here in Brooklyn on a bill with Steve Gunn and some other people.
Oh, and, lovely. You know, that's great.
Yeah. So, you know, the record is quite intimate. And you know, I don't have any idea what it's going to be like to try and play it in front of a crowd of people with beers in their hands or whatever, because it seems like a very private music to some degree. But, you know, we'll see what happens as far as that goes.
Well, I mean, you got Steve Gunn and I have become a little bit friendly of late. He was on the show this year, and
good.
I mean, that's a remarkable bill. So that's great. That's awesome. That's I'm glad you're
the
active.
Other thing I was gonna, me too. You know, it's I'm looking forward to things opening up. But you know, the one thing I wanted to say about that was, you know, I wanted to use this moment. I think a lot of people felt like these 18, you know, they wanted to just erase these 18 months and sort of pick up where they left off on March 1st, basically, and pretend it never happened. And for me, I'm feeling something very different from that. I'm a little hesitant about going forward because I really want to feel like going forward is a sort of like a rebirth, and like I want to be ready to do brand new things rather than just go back to the familiar old things that I was doing. I really want this break to have a meaning to it, you know?
Absolutely,
and so the fact that the three performances I've done so far were all so radically different is hopefully a good sign for going forward. I mean, Raul and I are kind of plotting our future in the same mode. It's like, let's not go back. And, you know, we never really got to perform the last record, and we could do that now. But I think our motivation is more to go forward and just keep pushing forward rather than try and recreate something that we were in the thick of, you know, 18 or 20 months ago. So that's my hope for going forward. Is I don't have particular immediate plans, but I want to work in a way where concert performances are more special, less routine, more specific, or maybe even almost like site specific, you know?
Absolutely. I agree.
That's my hope going forward.
Yeah. And that's my hope going forward for all of us, because the tension I'm experiencing now is that you're absolutely correct. I think you said this earlier, like the pandemic and this virus have been horribly tragic on several levels, but I do think we got time to think about how we all behave as humans. And my hope and my dread is that we don't take that reflection upon the way we used to live and the failure of it, whatever it is, like just taking what we just learned over the last 18, 20 months, however long it's been, about how we could be better, how we could do things better. I hope it's not just a simple regression back to people stuffing themselves onto subway cars or in traffic to get to play. Like, you know, there's just aspects of this time that I hope we use to our advantage and behave in ways that are more purposeful and less wasteful in every regard, time, environmentally, whatever. So, sorry, I just wanted to get on my soapbox for a second there, Lee, and echo, I think, some of what you're saying. I do want to ask you...
What I'm thinking the same thing.
Yeah, I think we're on this... I think we've been on the same wavelength for a long time, you and me, Lee, whether you knew it or not. And so...
Yep.
I wanted to ask you housekeeping questions. If people want to learn more about you and in virus times, about checking out the record, where would you like to direct people?
Well, I've got a pretty extensive website that's just leerinaldo.com that people can go there. My Instagram is usually a place where I try to keep up to date on my activities. And then Mute has a pretty nice page for my stuff, too. I mean, if you Google Lee Rinaldo Mute Records in virus times, you'll see that video we were talking about, and you'll see a lot of those loner notes kind of paraphrased as well. You know, things like that are in there. You know, the other... influence I wanted to say about the record, aside from the whole, I mean, well, the pandemic is the main influence, but there was a period over the summer during the pandemic where I've always loved the music of the composer Morton Feldman.
Yeah.
And if you know that music at all, it's very, very sparse and durational. Some of the pieces are like 2 hours, or I think there's one that's even 5 hours long. And there's not a lot of stuff happening in them. They're almost like these little bursts or blooms, and a lot of silence and open space. And I found that music so relevant for myself during the pandemic that I was just, I delved deeper into his catalog than I'd ever done before. And I was playing many of these tracks on repeat. So just all day long, they were kind of this ambience in the house. And I feel like even though my record doesn't sound like that music, something about listening to how deftly he worked with these sparse elements really gave me part of the motivation for keeping my record so simple.
I see. You know? I see. Well, I appreciate you shouting that out and pointing people to him. That's cool. But I do want, as I'm wont to do at the end of a conversation like this, I want to actually give people a flavor of what we've been talking about by way of perhaps sharing a song. And I wonder if it's permissible to you. The record is out as we're speaking. The record's out this Friday, the November 12th. I wonder, can you pick a song from In Virus Times for us to go out on? And if so, which one would you like people to hear?
Well, you know, they're all sort of four parts of the whole, but I would say I'm happy to have you play any one of them. I guess, you know, within your, I don't know what your time constraints are, but
there are none. There are none. You can pick whatever you want. Yeah.
Okay. Let's choose the last section. That's section four.
Sure.
And they're just called part 1 to 4. So they don't have track names other than part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. I mean, it's the resolution of the record in a way. And it's, it gives a little bit of the flavor without going on for too long, I guess.
Okay. Fair enough. Let's hear it. This is, part 4, from the beautiful new album In Virus Times by Lee Rinaldo. Lee, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for making time for me. And I hope we speak again, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Okay, same here, Vish. It's always great to talk to you. I can always be guaranteed we're going to have an in-depth conversation, which is the most appreciated thing. So you take care, and hopefully when things open up, maybe we'll meet in person at some point down the road.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's always very, very nice to speak with Lee Ranaldo. Lee, thank you so much for appearing on this, the 648th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network, and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it and you don't know where it is, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control's Facebook page or follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Instagram and on Facebook at vishkana. Also, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this show. $6 or more grants you access to exclusive archival content from my long history as a journalist and guy who interviews people. And so I dig through the archives every once in a while and try to post something up there that is not part of the regular show. And again, $6 or more in terms of a flexible monthly donation on the Patreon there. $6 or more a month grants you access to that content and other stuff too. And also, if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, please just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. Links for most of the things I just said and things I'm about to say are available in the episode description, depending on, well, probably however you're listening to this, hopefully there's a bunch of links right below it in the text there. Speaking of such links, thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about at blackbird.ca, and also to Pizza Trocadero, the Bookshelf and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks also to my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on this show. He's a sweetheart of a person, and you can learn more about him and his vast catalog of song at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Lee Ranaldo. Lee's been on the show a bunch of times, so if you haven't heard those episodes before, dig through the archives and see if you can find them. They're on my website and hopefully in the podcast platform you use. Speaking of the podcast, thanks for listening to it, as I say, but also consider subscribing to the show and maybe telling your friends about the show, and maybe they'll do the same things as you, listen to it and follow it and subscribe to it and help spread the word about it. If you can, that would be great. I appreciate it. And otherwise, I think that's it for me. I will talk to you very soon. Check out In Virus Times by Lee Ranaldo. Be well. Talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.